About partition functions of three-dimensional gravity. This is work to appear with Edward Witten. Although it's still, most of what I'm going to say is quite solid, but there are bits and pieces which are still works in progress, and hopefully I'll have some time to talk about them at the end of my talk. So because some of the computations that I'll be doing are a bit technical, I'll probably start just with a general overview to introduce the basic problem that I'm trying to address today, and also the basic techniques that I'll be using to address this problem. So the basic goal. Did someone have a question already? No. It's not working. Okay, I guess I can look up at the screen. So the goal of what I'm going to be talking about today is to quantize gravity in three dimensions. Now, of course, gravity in three dimensions is very different from gravity in higher dimensions. In particular, the equations of motion, Einstein's equations, completely fix the metric locally. So all you're left with are the global degrees of freedom associated to constant curvature metrics. And so for that reason, you might think that the theory was trivial. There are no propagating degrees of freedom. There are no gravitational waves. All you're dealing with are constant curvature metrics. However, that isn't quite true. Even though the theory seems quite simple, it contains rich gravitational physics. There are black hole solutions. There are phase transitions of the type described by Hawking and Page. When you have a negative cosmological constant, as I will today, you have an ADS-CFT correspondence. And so we can try and understand all of these rich features of gravitational physics in this very simplified example. And in particular, as I already mentioned, today I'll talk just about the case with a negative cosmological constant, which is to say negative curvature manifolds. So the theory has two coupling constants, a cosmological constant, which is negative and has dimensions of 1 over length squared. So here I've written it as minus 1 over L squared, where L is the curvature radius of my negative curvature space, and Newton's constant, which has dimensions of length in three dimensions. And so I can combine these two parameters into a single dimensionless coupling constant that I'll call K, which is just the curvature radius in units of Newton's constant. So, and this dimensionless coupling constant is the only coupling constant that will appear in the rest of my talk. So the two tools that I'll be using to study three-dimensional gravity are ADS-CFT and modular invariance. And so maybe I should just start by telling you a little bit about those two tools and how they apply to the case at hand. So first, and this will probably be familiar to most of the people, but I thought I might just include a very brief introduction. So anti-de Sitter space is the prototypical Lorentzian negative curvature, constant curvature space. You can think of it, if you want to, as a solid cylinder. So the boundary is just the cylinder living at the boundary. And the boundary of ADS3 is the cylinder parameterized by two coordinates. There's a Lorentzian time coordinate t and a spatial circular coordinate x. This boundary is called the conformal boundary because the isometries of ADS3, which are SL2R times SL2R, act on the cylinder out at infinity by conformal transformations. So I'm going to be talking about quantum gravity, which means that, at least heuristically, I'll be trying to compute an integral over a space of metrics. And in order to define such an integral, I need to set these boundary conditions on my integral over the space of metrics. And the way that I'll define these boundary conditions is by demanding that I'm considering only metrics with fixed conformal structure at infinity. So the name of the game is then to compute a partition function, which would be the partition function of quantum gravity, where I integrate over metrics with fixed conformal boundary. So here, I've written a Euclidean version of that partition function. So that's just an integral over a space of metrics with some measure factor determined by the action. And in three dimensions, the action is very simple. It's just the volume of the three manifold that I'm considering. And the only place that the coupling constant k arises is as a coefficient appearing in the exponent there. And as many people know, it turns out that this partition function will be the partition function of a two-dimensional conformal field theory. And this was observed by Maldacena in the context of string theory. But in fact, ADS-CFG, at least in three dimensions, is older than that. Brown and Hanau, about a decade earlier, pointed out that in three dimensions, the partition function and quantum gravity in anti-de Sitter space will have the structure of a conformal field theory. So what I'm going to be trying to do today is compute the partition function of the theory at finite temperature. So I started out with a Lorentzian time coordinate T, and to compute the finite temperature partition function, I'll turn that into a Euclidean time coordinate, T Euclidean up there, and I'll periodically identify it with period theta, which is the inverse temperature. So what that means is that I'm looking for Euclidean three manifolds, which are asymptotically a two torus. Now, this is a conformal boundary, and the conformal structure of a two torus is usually labeled by a complex parameter tau. And this complex parameter tau is invariant under modular transformations, which I've written up here. Tau goes to A tau plus B over C tau plus D, where A, B, C, and D form a matrix, which is an element of the modular group SL2Z. So what that means is that the partition function that I'm computing is going to be a modular function of this parameter tau, which is the complex temperature. And as many people have observed, but was emphasized by Witten in a paper that he wrote 4 or 5 months ago, modular invariance is an incredibly powerful constraint on the sorts of partition functions that I can get out here. So in particular, as Witten pointed out, if I assume only that the partition function is modular invariant and that it's a holomorphic function of tau, you learn an incredible amount just from those two very simple facts about what the theory will look like. So in particular, it turns out that these two constraints will imply that the coupling constant k is an integer, or physically, what this means is that the cosmological constant is quantized in Planck units. And moreover, modular invariance and holomorphicity will imply that all of the operators in the theory have integer dimension, which is to say all the energies of all of the states in the theories will have integer dimension. This theory includes black holes, and so in particular, this means that the masses of all the black holes in the theory will be quantized in ADS units. Yeah.
Why is E holomorphic?
This is okay. You didn't miss it. So in Witten's work over the summer, this was just an assumption. It was an assumption that he motivated by thinking about Chern-Simons theory. But it's just an assumption, and I think at this point, there's no good reason. Thank you for asking that question. That's a pretty well-timed question. There's no good reason. Well, there's no really solid argument for why the partition function should be holomorphically factorized. And in fact, it's precisely that question, which I wrote as the 64,000-dollar question down here. I guess that's 60,000 KPI. It's precisely that question which I think motivated the work that I'll be describing today. Yeah.
Well, but there's an alternate way of asking, or nearly equivalent way of asking this question, which makes it, to me anyway, sound more plausible that the answer should be yes. And that is, does the theory where k left equals zero exist?
I think that's a great way.
The theory where k left equals zero exists, it has to be holomorphic. It's a theory of C right is zero, so there can't be right over. So if you assume the existence of that theory, then it has to be holomorphic.
Let's put it this way. I agree with that philosophy. What I'm going to be doing today is trying to compute this partition function as honestly as I can.
by doing a sum over all known contributions to the partition function. Yeah. And it'll turn out that it's not homomorphically factorized. For reasons that are almost obvious. It's just a sum over real geometries, one copy of SL2Z and M2. But I'll also argue that the partition function that you get in that way doesn't have a decent interpretation of the quantum mechanical system. And so you need to add some other things. One of the things that you can add are additional geometries. Well, I'm now talking about my plan for today. One of the things that you can add in order to get holomorphic factorization are additional complex geometries. And I'll tell you what those geometries are and how they link to a holomorphically factorized partition function. So I think I agree with what you're saying.
If you had pressed the k left equals zero theories, would you have gotten to this?
What?
What do you expect the j left equal to zero case to be mounted on line? You might worry about the number of lines.
Maybe we can defer discussion of the finer points of my topic until we actually get it. Anyway, I was not intending to talk about the k left equals zero case, but I agree that it's a good thing to think about. In some ways, what I'm talking about today is much more complicated. I'm just going to be trying to compute the k left equals k right partition function as best I can. So, as I said, I'll try and compute this partition function. I'll conclude that it doesn't make sense quantum mechanically, and I need to consider a holomorphically factorized partition function. And then, if I have time at the end, I'll talk about a few very nice features of these holomorphically factorized partition functions. I'll describe how one can reproduce all sorts of subleading corrections to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, and I'll also describe how the Hawking-Page transition appears in these holomorphically factorized partition functions. So, first things first, let me tell you how we should compute the torus partition function. So first, let's just talk about tree-level physics, which is to say a saddle point approximation to the path integral. So in this case, the partition function is just given by a sum over all the solutions to the classical equations of motion, which have a T2 boundary. And each classical equation of motion will contribute a term of the form e to the minus k times the volume of that three-manifold, where M3 is a three-manifold with T2 boundary. I'll just be considering smooth three-manifolds, since I don't know how to define an action in the case where I allow M3 to have singularities. And in that case, these geometries are completely classified. This is not a new result. This is a fairly simple statement. In particular, if I think about my boundary 2 torus here, with two coordinates, t and x, then what these three manifolds look like are solid tori that fill in that abstract two torus living on the boundary. So I think, I don't know exactly who was the first person to point it out. It might have been Andy along with Juan. But there are many different ways, there are many different manifolds, in fact. There are many different three manifolds which represent solid tori that fill in this boundary two torus. In particular, there's an easy way of seeing that. So in this solid two torus, there's one cycle going around here which is not contractible, and there's another cycle here which is contractible. And so that means that somehow when we write down this three manifold, we've chosen some special cycle in the two torus which we've decided has to be contractible. And in particular, there's a different solid torus which fills in this boundary T2 for each choice of cycle that's contractible in the interior. In particular, I could choose some relatively prime pair of integers, which I've called C and D up there, and then the cycle CT plus DX, if I choose to make that cycle contractible in the interior, then that'll give me a unique choice of free manifold. So, these different three manifolds all have different physical interpretations. So in particular, let me call the complex structure of the boundary tau theta plus I beta, where beta is the temperature. Then the simplest possible manifold would be the one that I get by naively analytically continuing
Lorentzian ADS space to Euclidean ADS space, and then periodically identifying in Euclidean time. So for that manifold, the X cycle is contractible in the interior. So in terms of these two integers, C and D, that would correspond to setting C equals to 0 and D equals 1. And this geometry has a simple physical interpretation. It's just the geometry associated with thermal anti-de-Sitter space, with temperature beta and angular potential, which was the real part of tau here, theta. But one of the interesting things is that, in fact, there are lots of other geometries. So for example, there's the geometry where the time circle is contractible and the space circle isn't. So that would be M10. So it turns out that this geometry is the Euclidean BTZ black hole. And the parameter tau here is now the, well, it would be the complexified Hawking temperature of that black hole. And in fact, there's a whole other zoo of solutions, one for each relatively prime pair of integers C and D, which are known as the SL2Z family of black holes, which were originally studied by Juan and Andy. So we have this whole set of solutions to the equations of motion. So what are their contributions to the path integral? Well, first, let me tell you a nice way of labeling. Yeah?
What does it mean if you go back to the Lorentzian case?
So I don't think there is a clear Lorentzian interpretation of these other points. I think that you should really just think about them as Euclidean sound points. I think this one, where the time circle is contractible, that has a nice physical interpretation. Because, well, when the time circle shrinks to zero, that's the horizon, that's practically the definition of a horizon of a black hole. But when these other cycles are contractible, I don't know a nice, straightforward Lorentzian interpretation. Andy, maybe you
There's certainly rotating black holes coming in here. Right?
Well, I think M10, I think, should be thought of rotating as a rotating black hole because it has. Well,
if
also
it's
when you put Euclidean
signature,
when you put Euclidean signature, you need to complexify the
interior.
So I think it's a little subtle to talk about exactly what these mean in a Lorentzian context, because to have complex angular.
Well, I think you should just think about it as a contribution to, I mean, there's a question of whether you make the angular potential real or complex.
Yeah.
But when theta is zero, the sky is not rotating.
That's
okay. So if you change theta, it starts rotating.
Sure.
Now, by changing theta, you can move these different solutions.
That's
one. So I think that these are very subtle points with different amounts of complex.
Yeah. I think that's as good a physical interpretation. That's not too good. So
what I'd like to tell you now is well, I've called them the SL. I've already used the word SL2Z. So let me tell you why I've used that word. Well, each geometry was labeled by a relatively prime pair of integers, C and D. Since C and D are relatively prime, that means that I could choose some matrix gamma sitting inside SL2Z, which has C and D as its bottom two elements. This element gamma in SL2Z isn't uniquely defined. It's only defined up to shifts by the action of Z, where Z now here is the subgroup of SL2Z generated by matrices of that form. So it just turns out that each geometry then can be associated with an element of SL2Z mod Z in that way. And the important point is that these various different black holes, that these various different saddle points that we're studying are then all related to each other by SL2Z modular transformations. So for example, if you calculate the contribution to the partition function by computing the volume of this three manifold, then it just turns out to be the imaginary part of gamma acting on tau, where tau is the complex structure parameter. So of course, these are all infinite three manifolds. So technically speaking, the volume is infinite. But if you compute an appropriate volume, taking into account the appropriate boundary terms, you actually get a finite answer, which is equal to the imaginary part of of tau acted on by this element gamma.
Summing over geometries, because this is the theory in which the connection and the, when K left is, this is the theory in which the connection and the Verbein are independent, and when K left and K right are not equal, the equation of motion, there's no, it's not true that the connection becomes set equal to.
So I think that when K left is not equal to K right, you probably have to do something very different.
We're only talking about K left.
We're only talking about K left equals
that's
K
right. Like a singular point here. Isn't it weird to just to have an analysis which is only valid for K left equals K right and expect to be able to see holomorphic factorization in that? I mean, because holomorphic factorization is saying that
That it doesn't matter.
That it doesn't matter. So if your analysis is, or, I mean, there's more stuff that is going to appear the second that K left is not equal to K right,
okay.
Or even at this level.
That's certainly true. That's certainly true. So I think that it would be interesting to do an analysis of this when K left is not equal to K right, but I haven't done it. Okay, I'll stop there. So, I mean, I'd like to talk more about this. So when I write down the full partition function, which is the sum over all of the geometries, that's a sum over C and D, which is to say it's a sum over SL2Z mod Z. And sums over SL2Z mod Z have a name, they're called Poincaré series. And so our partition function is then this particular fairly simple looking Poincaré series. Now it's not so hard to see just by thinking about this that in fact this sum is convergent. It's not just logarithmically convergent, but in fact I believe it's linearly or maybe even quadratically divergent. Let's press on because you know we're physicists, not mathematicians.
You're reading only the some classical sum. You expect in that theory you might expect some random corrections or some measure factor.
You'll notice that I don't slide. That's an excellent question. So what we'd really like to do is to evaluate higher order corrections to this partition function. So for example, we'd like to compute a one-loop determinant by taking into account the nearby geometries around three and full. So of course, in principle, what I'd like to do is just do that directly by literally computing a one-loop determinant, but that's a very difficult computation. And so instead, what I'll do is I'll use a trick. So first of all, I told you that M01 was just thermally the S3. So what that means is that the partition function then has a very simple Hamiltonian interpretation. It's just the trace e to the minus theta h plus some angular momentum term, where I'm taking the trace of the Hilbert space of small fluctuations around ADS3. And the point is that Brown and Hanau told us exactly what that Hilbert space is. We find it by quantizing the phase space of classical solutions around ADS3. And because we're talking about gravity, we only talk about classical solutions, which are different modulo some diffeomorphism that vanishes sufficiently quickly at conformal infinity. And Brown and this is not a new calculation here, because Brown and Hanau essentially told us exactly what this Hilbert space is. In particular, the Hilbert space contains a vacuum state, which we could call zero, which is empty ADS3. And because we should think about this Hilbert space as the Hilbert space of a conformal field theory, it also includes Virasoro descendants. So Brown and Hanau wrote down exactly what the Virasoro operators are in this theory, and we can act with them on the vacuum state to write down some Virasoro descendant, which should be thought of as some kind of excitation of empty anti-de Sitter space. And then we can just go ahead and take the trace of the operator e to the minus beta h in this Hilbert space, and we come up with a partition function. And this is the usual sort of partition function that appears whenever you're considering a conformal field theory. For example, a free boson on a circle has a partition function that looks something like this. So this is not particularly new.
But there's one important point that we should note, which is that this structure is very highly constrained by the symmetries of the problem. So in particular, the Hilbert space that we've written down is a representation of the symmetry group of the theory. The symmetry group of the theory is just the Virasoro algebra. That's what Brown and Hanau showed us. And in particular, they showed us that it's the Virasoro algebra with a central extension where semi-classically, the central charge is just determined in terms of k. So semi-classically, the central charge is just 24k. And the important point is that this partition function that I've written down, this particular form for the partition function is a function is derived only using this asymptotic symmetry analysis. So in particular, this family of states transform in a representation of the Virasoro algebra, and this representation is essentially unique once you decide what the central charge is. So what that means is that once you fix the central charge, the energy levels appearing in this representation are completely fixed, and they won't be corrected at higher order powers than k. So in that sense, there won't be any further perturbative corrections to this partition function. Is that clear? Okay. So we can now go back and look at our sum over geometries again. So in particular, what we have is a Poincaré series, where again, we're summing over SL2Z mod Z of now this more complicated partition function that I wrote down for you over here. And well, this is a more complicated Poincaré series, but we can still try and do it. So the first thing that you would note if you tried to do this sum is that it's divergent. But it can be regularized. And conceptually, the way that we should think about this regularization is as follows. So even though the partition function diverges, there are correlation functions in the theory, which are still given by Poincaré series of this form, and these correlation functions converge. So one set of correlation functions given by a convergent Poincaré series could be found by acting on this partition function with a suitable differential operator. So here I've chosen an operator which is just the Laplacian on the upper half plane minus a quarter for technical reasons. And this differential operator, when you act it on this partition function, gives you a convergent sum. That's not 100% obvious, given the things that I've written down, but it's something that you can check. And then the important point is that this sum delta minus a quarter acting on Z is a convergent series, so you can do the sum. And then you can use the fact that this operator is an invertible operator. And so that just defines for you some regularized version of the partition function. So physically, there's this completely straightforward way of deciding what you mean by the regularized partition function. And it gives you a unique SL2Z invariant answer for what this partition function should be. Unfortunately, this sort of schematic regularization procedure that I've written for you here is awfully complicated, because you start with some horrible function, then you do some horrible sum of that horrible function, then you take some horrible derivatives acting on that horrible function, then you take some horrible inverse of these horrible derivatives to get another horrible function. So this regularization procedure that I've outlined for you here is technically very difficult to do, but it's completely equivalent to a much simpler sort of regularization, which is essentially zeta function regularization. So that's an important question. The point is that if you look at square integrable functions on H2 mod SL2Z of the fundamental region, then this particular differential operator that I've written down is invertible. It has no zero. It has no eigenfunctions with zero eigen. In particular, if you remember what the spectrum of the Laplacian on hyperbolic space looks like, it's got a continuous piece, which runs from a quarter up to infinity.
But because we're considering the fundamental region, which has finite volume, there also could be some discrete pieces. And it turns out to be a fact about SL2Z that the first eigenvalue of the Laplacian, the first discrete eigenvalue of Laplacian, it's something like 91.4, which is, and 91.4 is bigger than 4. So, okay. So it's a technical fact about the SL2Z.
Similar questions.
I should mention there are other modular groups where that where this fact is not true. There are other modular groups where you can direct where you have one quarter, which is not bigger than one quarter. So it's just a technical fact that it's up to say.
So that's presumably not a unique differential operator.
No, there are many such differential operators.
Or I guess rephrasing the question there is that if I use a different differential operator, which will also happen to be invertible, but I guess it's
you'll get the same answer. You'll always, I mean, just by writing down the Zig function regularization, you could act with that differential operator on this guy, and then you could check that you'll just get the same.
Sorry, just gamma was the SL2Z operator on tau, right?
Yeah.
And so this is a modular invariant, not a form. Let's see.
Z is a modular invariant function. When you act with this derivative, it becomes a form. So the way that I've defined this, so I've called this zeta function regularization. It's not exactly the same as the zeta function regularization you'd use in quantum field theory, but it's pretty darn close. Basically, all I did is I took this Poincaré series, and I, so this is the guy that I'm trying to sum, and then I insert some function here. This is, in fact, a modular invariant function. And then I have a parameter here, S. So you can see that when S is large, we have a large power of C and D in the denominator here, which is going to make this guy converge. And so we can do this sum for large S. Think about this sum as an analytic function of S, and then analytically continue to the point S equals 0. And that gives us a regularized version of this partition function.
Can you write this as this, you know, in sort of a CFT way, as a sum over left and right holomorphic modular forms?
I don't know. Maybe we can, yeah, I don't even know how I would start to do that. This is a very, notice that this is not a holomorphic function that I've written here.
Right.
So it might be that a more clever thing to do would be to find something holomorphic that you could put in here. Especially
if we compute the partition function of the type 2 string, yeah. It's not holomorphic, it's a modular function.
Yeah.
But it's a sum of, modular forms, left modular, you know, some modular, put together with some modular invariant combination.
Well, maybe I can. I don't know whether I could do that. Maybe we can talk about that.
Can you tell from this expression what the gap is, the lowest line excitation of the BTC black hole? It's got black holes in it, right?
It's got black. So I'm gonna get.
Okay.
Why don't we come back to that? So first of all, I have to show you. Okay, so I've written down here a sort of formal expression for what the regularized partition function is, and now I need to compute it for you. I've called it zeta function regularization, and there's a reason why I've called it zeta function regularization, which is that essentially what I've written down for you is a zeta function. Unfortunately, it's not the Riemann zeta function, it's something called the Selberg zeta function, which is associated to the fundamental domain H2 mod SL2Z. And so there's good and bad things about the fact that it's a Selberg zeta function. The good thing, so, you know, this is a function which has a name. That's good because it means mathematicians have studied it a lot. But it's bad because it means it was complicated enough that it deserved its own name. And so it's not computable. And it's not just some elementary function that you could look up in Gradstein and Rishik or something like that. So it's this complicated zeta function evaluated at S equals 0. And the fact that
The limit where I take s equals to 0 exists is because of precisely this question that you asked. In fact, it involves the fact that the lowest eigenvalue of the Laplacian on the SL2Z fundamental region, well, there's just no discrete eigenvalue at a quarter. And then, although I don't want to go through any of the details for you, there's a straightforward, although sort of tedious computation that you can do to compute the various terms in this partition function, in this regularized partition function. So let me just write down for you what these terms look like. So I'm computing here the partition function as a function of tau, where tau is equal to something plus I beta. Then there's a normal piece, which is just the usual thermal ADS partition function, plus some exponentially suppressed corrections at large beta, plus a series of polynomial terms, which I've written here in terms of some coefficients, C0, C1, C2, and so forth. And with enough work, you can go ahead and calculate these coefficients. So I've written down the first two of them here. The first one's not so bad. The next one's a little worse. And, you know, they get more and more complicated from there. But the important thing that I want to emphasize is that we have this polynomial series in 1 over beta that's appearing in this partition function. And that has very important physical implications. So in particular, the first question we should ask is whether this partition function has a sensible interpretation as coming from the trace over some Hilbert space of some quantum mechanical system. So in particular, what should such a trace look like? Well, if I want to take trace of e to the minus beta h plus some angular momentum piece, then in order for this trace to be finite, which is to say in order for this sum to converge, it needs to be a sum over some discrete eigenvalues, delta and delta bar, of some integer coefficients, which I've called f of delta and delta bar, times q and q bar. So in particular, this is an almost trivial statement here. Any convergent partition function of any quantum mechanical system will have this form where it's a sum of some discrete set of exponentials, which are exponentially decaying in beta, or exponentially growing in beta at large beta. And then all you have to do is go back and look at this partition function that we wrote down. So we've got this guy here, which is basically some exponentials coming from the Brown and Hanau states. You had some other exponentials over here, but then you had this whole series of polynomial terms here. And because of these polynomial terms, it's pretty easy to see that there's just no way that the answer that you get from this regularized partition function could ever be gotten as trace of e to the minus beta h, where h is some nice Hamiltonian acting on some quantum mechanical Hilbert space. So the most straightforward way of seeing that is just to notice that this is some polynomial power series in 1 over beta, whereas what we're really expecting is some exponential term in e to the minus beta or e to the plus beta. And even, you know, even if we'd done this calculation and miraculously all of these weird polynomial terms had vanished, the fact that I have a negative integer here also means that this can't have a quantum mechanical interpretation. Yeah.
Couldn't you have had some series stuff that
If I had a series in beta at 1 over beta, I could have imagined summing it up. But I have a series in 1 over beta. And you can just stare at this long.
You have a series in 1 over beta, and you're concluding that it could never have arisen, and such terms would never have arisen.
Yeah.
Is it in what? In e to the beta?
I mean, I probably shouldn't have written this in terms of q and q bar. What I really mean is e to the what this trace is going to look like is the sum over some discrete set of eigenstates of some integer times e to the beta h.
e to the beta delta plus delta. Forget about that angular momentum case. And it's just a fact that if you want this to be some, if you want this to be a convergent sum, then it has to be a sum of exponentials. It has to be some set of discrete exponentials. And these exponentials could never give you this
polynomial. Beta is log of e to the beta plus 1 minus 1. And then I take this and expand it. You're saying that there's no function that has an... So e to the beta is small if beta goes to plus infinity.
Yeah.
And you're worried about what happens if beta equals 0.
I'm worried about what happens if the values of beta.
Well, but you're expanding in these poles, right?
Well, but the point is that I want... This is supposed to be a standard... So what I'm assuming here is that quantum gravity in three dimensions, negative cosmological constant, can be a standard quantum mechanical system with a Hilbert space and a Hamiltonian, such that the trace of e to the minus beta h converges.
Why should quantum live?
That's my assumption. That converges.
Why can't you just say that the 1 over beta comes from the fact that the sum doesn't converge?
So, yes.
In fact, with a theory of black holes, you would never expect that sum to converge.
Really?
Certainly not in four dimensions, because they have negative specific heat. Yeah, I expect
black holes have positive specific heat.
In BTZ, I guess they have positive specific heat. But what is the entropy? There's no distinction
between large ones and small ones.
Well, they're very different. Yes, three.
So they all have positive specific.
They all have positive.
I think they do.
Maybe.
What is the entropy going like as a function of temperature for BTZ?
1/(β).
The entropy is going like. Like 1/(β). Yeah, so it doesn't converge. All right, why would you expect it? It grossly does the converge in four dimensions, because you take e to the minus b beta e times the entropy, like which is going like e to the e squared. Right. Now you're taking e to the minus beta times the entropy. Yeah, so it's what we think. Entropy is going like 1/(β).
So I'm interested in calculating a free energy kind of state, whether that converges. The free energy goes like, so the integral that I would do in your case would be the integral d beta of e to the minus 1/(β) squared, which is a bounded number of convergence.
No, the entropy has the other sign. It's e to the plus 1/(β) squared. Entropy has a sign.
The free energy of the BTZ black hole is plus 1/(β). Not calculating even minus, or maybe that's data.
The partition function is going like e to the, if the entropy is going like 1/(β, the partition function is going like e to the 1/(β, and then minus beta e. And that thing doesn't look very convergent if beta equals 0.
Beta equals 0.
Because e to the plus 1/(β) is very good.
Well, I guess I don't really... I guess I don't really see a reason why I should trust that the beta equals 0 BTC black holes.
Well, maybe you shouldn't, but I think the burden is on you, because you made the assumption that the partition function was convergent.
The real reason why I think this is a convergent is because of ABS-CFT. So, for example, if I have a dual...
It's circular.
If I have a dual conformal field theory, this is a standard quantum mechanical system with a Hamiltonian and a Hilbert space. The partition function is just some number that's a function of beta,
okay,
which converges.
Yeah, but it could well be that the partition function for Schwarzschild black holes in ADS 5 process 5 does not converge.
But partition function of n equals 4 Yacmils on a sphere.
That's right. So that's just a statement that if you organize it rightly, it converges.
Right.
But if you do it in the quantum gravity variables, it looks like it doesn't converge, and you have to do some analytic continuation, blah, 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 blah. So just because it converges in one expansion doesn't mean it converges in every expansion.
I have a hard time. Well, I just have a hard time seeing how. I mean, the partnership function of n equals 40 animals on a sphere
converges in an expansion in what? Not in every possible expansion parameter. Certainly,
it's just. I guess it's just a number.
Sorry, why does it converge? I thought field theories were never converged.
On a sphere. It's got a discrete effect.
Quantum diagram expansion doesn't converge. I mean, lots of ways of describing it won't converge. So in order to get the energy eigenvalues, you'd have to do some non-convergent sum over quantum diagrams, make it converge by some analytic continuation. And then when you got the energy eigenvalues, yes, that would converge. But
Right, exactly.
If you're doing the calculation in some other way.
I guess, you know, what I'm comparing here is the partition function is a function of energy. And I only know of one way of regularizing that to get a finite answer. And then I'm asking whether that finite answer can be ever written as the sum of e to the minus big H. And that's the yes or no question, and the answer is no.
Okay, so you might conclude from that that the sum organized in this way is not converged.
I guess I don't know. There's no organizing the sum like a finite answer.
Well, you set out to make a semi-classical approximation to something which, had it existed, would be the trace of e to the minus beta h string occurrence.
So I think one.
You talked your way through a semi-classical approximation to that by some assumptions about the measure and so forth. And if you reach any conclusion at all, it's that the semi-classical approximation is not good when you're asking questions at infinite t.
I guess I'm talking about finite temperature, finite beta. I'm calculating a partition function, I'm getting a number. And then I'm asking about that function, that is a function of beta.
Well,
and that's, I'm not talking, I've computed a partition function as a function of beta. It might be that the computation is wrong. It might be that there's some deep reason why the partition function shouldn't converge as a function of beta. That's a possibility. But what's not a possibility is that the partition function that I've computed by including all known contributions to the path integral has an expression in terms of the sum of e to the minus beta h.
Convergence. It could be a non-convergent sum.
Yes. I'm assuming, so the basic assumption that I'm making, as I said, is that the partition function is a standard quantum mechanical system with a Hamiltonian and a Hilbert space such that trace e to the minus beta h converges when beta is positive, has a positive real part. That's the only assumption I'm making, but it's an assumption. But I think that I don't see any reason why that assumption should be wrong. I'm happy to talk about this more, because this is one of the important points.
Wait, is this even true in conformal field? And what about the Hagedorn transition? Let's see. Don't we already see at the level of a single string world sheet? Doesn't this sound... Wait, is this the same?
Well, it's another example. I mean, a small beta is infinite t. And at infinite t, the Hagedorn stuff overlaps the other stuff. If I'm understanding you, then that's...
If we take free field theory on a circle.
Yeah, so for example...
Doesn't that sum diverge when we reach...
I guess I'm...
So it's not even true in conformal field theory for free field theory on a circle that the sum is absolutely convergent.
I guess I'm not. What do you say?
The Hagedorn transition. E to the minus beta h.
Yeah, I mean, there's a... The sum diverges when you approach the Hagedorn temperature.
So if it's equal for infinite t, which is spanning around zero beta h, you wouldn't expect a convergent sum.
I guess this is not a sum. So the point is that what I've computed here is not a sum. We've computed the actual function as a function of beta.
How you're telling me it's a convergent expression. There's no resumming. There's no taking limits. There's nothing like that. It's so just a function.
If you take a free field theory on a circle,
if you take a field theory on a circle, then it has a discrete spectrum.
No, if you take a free field theory, if you take a free field theory on a circle, when you compute the partition function on a, is it even true? In order to get a modular invariant partition function on the circle, you have to include states which are sort of winding modes around the time direction.
So is it a finite temperature partition function?
The finite temperature partition.
Yeah.
If you expand that around infinite temperature, where these winding modes become very important, does that have an interpretation of the type you're looking for again?
The Hagedorn transition says that clearly at particular values of beta, the free energy is infinite.
And you're past that. You're at infinite temperature.
You may be able to identify. And then here it includes the whole component. Get some functions. Get some other. You can probably pass it, but you support.
Is it true that if we take a free field theory with a periodically identified boson, that it obeys the property?
You're talking about a conformal field theory?
Yeah, single free scalar with a periodically identified.
Well, I think
At infinite temperature, that there's no terms with.
The statement that I'm trying to make is very simple. If you can't write the partition function as a sum of exponentials in this form where you have a discrete set of states and some finite integers, then you can't have a convergent partition function.
Right. So the partition function isn't converted.
Right.
Is the partition function for a free scalar at finite radius conversion?
Well, it sounds like it's not. Be a little careful when you're talking about quantum field theory or even string theory in infinite spaces, because in that case, the partition function always converges. The free energy is always infinite, because you're talking about infinite.
I'm taking periodic.
Well, maybe I can continue. This is an assumption that I'm making. It's an assumption that's true for all simple, straightforward quantum mechanical systems, for the Hamiltonian and Hilbert space. But it's an assumption.
But it might not be true for a free scalar field theory on a circle.
Well, are you talking about? I guess I'm confused as to what you're talking about. Are you talking about quantum field theory? Or are you talking about string theory of quantum?
I'm just talking about is it true that a 1 plus 1 conformal field theory, if you compute its partition function?
I believe that's true.
That it has a convergent expansion of the
on
what you have here.
Yeah, I think that's true. It has a convergent expansion.
So I think we're following you, but you're about to say something more provocative that it doesn't have a sensible quantum mechanical interpretation. Let me back up and ask. So I mean, this is 2+1 gravity that has a constant on a plane with certain boundary.
Yes.
And that has a Hilbert space, which is a space of functionals with a certain norm over a space of certain flat dimensions on the plane.
will then set it to your boundary condition.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. And that has an H, which is the boundary on Hamiltonian.
Yes.
Okay. And so there is a Hilbert space.
That's the, so the thing
how
that
does not have a
the thing that I know the thing that I know how to define in that sense is the well is the computation that I outlined in terms of small fluctuations around the HS3. So in that case, I have an asymptotic symmetry group, which is diff S1 with some central extension. I have a phase space, which is diff S1. Which is diff S1 mod SL2R, and I know how to quantize that phase space. But now all I'm doing is, but that's only for small excitations around KDS3.
Why is that? That if you make out exact phase spaces, it says cotangent bundle of the state.
Maybe we're talking about.
We're talking about 2 plus 1 gravity thing,
yeah.
Plus module transfer.
Yeah.
So modulo issues about non-compactness of the Lie algebra connection versus compactness. This is nullified.
Well, it doesn't have a discrete Hamilton. It does have a discrete Hilbert space.
In this case, I don't know. Is it null? I don't know.
I mean, is there
by discrete,
you calculate
a countable basis?
Yeah. Can you calculate the eigenvalues of a Hamiltonian?
Yeah, so I don't know.
Okay. I mean, I think what
it is known, but I
think what you're talking about sounds in principle right, but it's a very difficult computation. And I would like to see it.
For the non-compact case, there are issues for the non-compact case. That's why I'm hesitating. So you're going to talk about it.
I just have a question on
sure.
The restriction that you specified on the discrete. So
yeah.
If you can't have any continuous.
So, I mean, physically, it's okay. So, if you want a convergent partition function, then the spectrum has to be discrete. But you don't always need to have. There are theories without convergent partition functions. So, for example, theories with long strings. You know, these are theories where you have some sort of string, and you can take all the way up to the boundary with. And it only costs a finite amount of energy. And so that means you have a continuous spectrum above some energy level. And so one resolution of this puzzle is that the theory has a continuous spectrum. One way that it gets continuous spectrum is by having long strings. Another possible resolution of this puzzle is that quantum mechanics, you know, quantum gravity in 2 plus 1 dimensions simply doesn't make sense as a standard quantum mechanical system.
But one solution could be that it has a continuous spectrum.
One solution could be that it has a continuous spectrum. And the example, and the possible way of getting a continuous spectrum that I know is by having long strings. Just because they could go all the way up to the boundary and probably cost a finite energy. And these are things that exist in string theory constructions of ADS3 times whatever. Sometimes you have these long strings.
Always.
You have to have.
You always have. Can they always go out to the back? There are always certain points in moduli space where they can go out to the
back. You have an inconsistency if you don't have the long strings. Because if you don't have the long strings, then the gap is too big. And you run into a contradiction with semi-classical mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
Semi-classical analysis.
Right.
The Hawking analysis breaks down before it should. So, in every case that we
so what I'm trying to construct here is as close to a theory of pure gravity as I can. And it might be that that's only consistent if you have long strings.
Well, this definitely doesn't have long strings, right?
It might be that you can't define it consistently without long strings. That's what I'm saying.
But long strings have fractional level numbers, so you'll never get a holomorphically factorized theory with long strings.
Well, so far, I haven't gotten the holomorphically factorized theories.
Oh, yet. I see.
Okay. I'm saying
this here. But
okay, here. Okay, what was the last sentence? Are there other possibilities? Okay. One possibility is that you need to include long strings. And so, for example, in all the string theories that we know, with ADS3 ground states, you have long strings. So it seems like that's a reasonable possibility. But as you say, it doesn't give you homomorphic factorization. At least not in any easy way that I can say. So there's another possibility, which is that, well, one possibility is that we should include complex geometries. So, well, maybe I should, were there any other questions? Are we done with the discussion here? Because I'm happy to talk more about this, even though I'm running out of time. But, yeah. Over the last several years, there have been several different times where complex geometries have appeared to be ESCFT. So, for example, if you want to calculate a two-point function on the boundary of anti-de Sitter space in Lorentzian signature, then the way that you actually do that, so two-point functions in ADS are found by looking at geodesics going through the bulk. And if you actually look at the calculation, then it turns out that in order to get the right answer, at least for certain correlation functions, you need to include complexified geodesics. And likewise, if you want to calculate certain Wilson loops on the boundary, then you need to include complexified surfaces going through the bulk of anti-de Sitter space. So it might not be so unreasonable to think that you need to include complex geometries here. In particular, what we're really trying to understand here is a Lorentzian path integral. Sometimes when you do Lorentzian integrals by continuing them off the complex plane, you have to deform the contour of integration, and sometimes you can pick up complex saddle points. Unfortunately, I don't know precisely how to do that Lorentzian path integral, and so I don't know of a solid argument that you should necessarily pick up these particular complex geometries. So right now, what I'm going to have to do is assume for the time being that the contour integral does in fact pick up such complex geometries, and then ask what happens if we include these complex geometries. But I think it's an open and very important and unfortunately very difficult question to determine whether or not there's a real solid argument for including these complex geometries. So what do these complex geometries look like? Well, I won't describe them in too much detail, but just remind you that at the classical level, yeah?
That's a natural thing to do in a theory where E and omega are independent. It's the simplest.
Well, it's certainly a reasonable thing to do. Do you know of a?
I think it's more reasonable than what we were doing before, which was ignoring the fact that they weren't.
Well, when K left equals, so you want to go back to K left not equals here, right?
Well, okay. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem hopeful that you will use some set of rules that only make sense when k left is equal to k right, and that will reproduce the.
It's certainly possible. Okay, so it may be that if you consider k left not equal to k right, then you will. Then this is a much natural thing to do. I haven't really thought about that theory, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you look at this complexified speed reduction function, there's the question is how do you make sure that on the boundary somehow you fix only the metric? Is that an issue? Or?
Well, I guess.
Because it looks like then the A and the bar are independent, whereas they are kind of.
That's right. Well, I mean, the basic point is that what I want to do is I want to consider the A and A bar sectors separately. What these black holes look like in terms of these connection variables is they look like you have a Wilson line going around one of these loops. So I have two cycles in my torus. And I'm turning on a Wilson line along one of those loops. But the point is that in these solid geometries, one of the loops was contractible. And so I could never turn on a Wilson loop around that cycle. And so in order to turn on different Wilson lines going around different cycles, you really need to imagine that you're having the left and right connections living on different three-down holes. And in particular, all I'm demanding is that they're free manifolds with the same conformal structure. I don't know if that answers your question.
Oh.
You know, I was just asking how you make the matching that the infinity somehow the read part of A should be the same as the read part of A bar.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Because this is where the geometry comes from.
Well, no, that's the point. That's why we end up with a complex metric. The point is that we're not imposing the fact that A equals A bar by anyone. So let me just do this formal procedure where I allow A and A bar to live on different intervals. And then I rewrite this in terms of the metric degrees of freedom, and then I ask, what sort of metric do I get? And the answer is that you get a metric that's not real. And so this is why I'm calling these complex geometries. I mean, it might be that the fact that I'm needing to call these things complex geometries means that the metric is just not the right degree of freedom to be considered here, and I should just be talking about pH degrees of freedom or some other degrees of freedom, where I don't have to talk about complexified metrics. I'm just using the, but, well, so that might be one avenue to pursue. Well, so let me just go ahead and tell you what happens if I do consider these complexified geometries. Well, then again, in order to compute, so now the partition function will almost by construction be holomorphic, so it'll be the square of some holomorphic function that I've called z. And again, this holomorphic function is given by a Poincaré series. And that Poincaré series is very similar. It's just sort of a holomorphic version of the Poincaré series that I wrote down for you earlier. And as before, we can try and sum up that Poincaré series. Now, instead of summing over a single copy of SL2z, I'm summing over two copies of SL2z, mod z. So the sum is actually more divergent than it was before because I'm summing over twice as many variables. But that's okay. We can still regularize the sum using zeta function regularization. Or there are other kinds of regularization one can use. But the point is that because we're now doing a holomorphic sum, it's a much simpler beast. And in particular, all those pesky polynomial terms disappeared. And so the resulting partition function can now just be thought of as the trace of e to the minus beta h, where h is a Hamiltonian, and I'm tracing over some nice Hilbert space. And that partition function is a convergent function for all values of beta that are bigger than zero. And that's in contrast with the partition function that I wrote down earlier, several slides ago, which had those polynomial terms which prevented you from thinking about it as a convergent trace of e to the minus beta h. So, well, I guess you can all guess now what the answer is once I do this sum. The answer for this partition function is precisely the one that Witten wrote down over the summer, which has become known as his holomorphic extremal partition function. It has some form that is not terribly important for what I'm talking about today in terms of Hecke operators and modular and Klein's modular invariant function. But the important point is that this is a holomorphic partition function, which is given as a sum over some discrete set of states. Now here, the dimension delta is an integer of e to the minus beta h times some positive integers here. And it's the fact that we have a sum over a discrete set and some positive integers appearing here, which is why we can think about this as a decent quantum mechanical partition sum. So this, I think, is, well, I probably should stop, shouldn't I? I've been going for about an hour. Okay, well, I had more to say, but it's been a lively talk. So I guess I won't have a chance to say them. Maybe if you guys will give me just a couple more minutes, I can briefly gloss over a few things. So we can talk about black hole entropy in the theory. In Witten's original paper, one of the pieces of evidence that he gave for this holomorphically factorized partition function is that one can reproduce the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole, of the BGC black hole, by looking at the various coefficients that appear in this partition function. So this was an example of one of the partition functions. the fact that these integers here are all small, these are just the Brown-Hanault states, and this sort of interesting looking number there, that's large because it's an exponentially large black hole entropy. And then he studied he wrote down a formula for what these coefficients are, and he verified that it reproduces the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And one can go a step further. So for example, the calculation that I described for you earlier was a one-loop determinant around thermal ADS, which is equivalent to saying a one-loop determinant around the BTZ black hole. So that computation allows you to extract all sorts of subleading factors in the black hole entropy. It gives you an infinite series. It gives you, so here I've written down some expression for the black hole entropy. And if you look at this one-loop determinant that I wrote down, it gives you an infinite series of subleading corrections to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And you can write them down and you can match them term by term with the terms that appeared in this holomorphic partition function, and they all agree. So in fact, there's an infinite series of subleading terms in the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, which can be computed semi-classically and compared and matched with the terms that appear in Witten's holomorphically factorized extremal conformal field theory. This is, in some sense, this is kind of a tautological statement because I used this. Well, it's a little tautological because let's put it this way. When Witten constructed his extremal CFTs, he didn't use, so the way that I have gone about constructing these extremal CFTs is as a Poincaré series, one of whose sums, you know, one of the terms in the series is precisely this set of subleading terms. And so from that point of view, it's almost by construction that I had to reproduce all of these things. But I think the one, so this is not a terribly surprising fact from that point of view.
This is even more. If I derive some point charge and derive likely as this, then I call the formula and the correction.
These are corrections to Fardier's formula. These are precisely, you know, these are just the corrections to Fardier's formula.
Usually they're controlled by just the effective central charge.
They're controlled by the central charge. So the leading term is the central charge, but there are all sorts of subleading terms, which depend on the dimensions of various operators of the theory. So for example, you know, this is, Okay, so let me just tell you one last thing, which I think is a lot of fun. I told you about this infinite class of free manifolds that are labeled by these pairs of integers C and D. And for different values of tau, different geometries dominate the partition function, which means that quantum gravity in three dimensions has a phase diagram. This region up at the top that I won't be able to reach is the region that's corresponds to large beta, which means small temperature, and that's dominated by thermal ADS. This region down here is dominated by the BTZ black hole. That line separating the two of them is the line where the Hawking-Page transition occurs. And then you have this infinite set of other states, which I've sort of drawn in dark black lines here. This tessellation of the upper half plane by the action of SL2Z is precisely the phase diagram of quantum gravity in three dimensions. And actually, Andy and Juan sort of pointed this out. So this presents a bit of a puzzle, because in particular, just this semi-classical analysis should tell you that as you move from one region to another, you have a phase transition. And typically, phase transitions, almost the definition of a phase transition, is something which is non-analytically tangible. So we expect, because of this phase diagram, that there'll be some non-analyticities in the partition function. But the partition function that I wrote down for you in its holomorphically factorized form is an analytic function. It's a holomorphic function by construction. And so this appears to be a bit of a contradiction. But the resolution to this, so it turns out this problem was studied many decades ago by Li Yang and by Fisher, and what they argued in a different context, I believe it was the Isaac model, actually, but the same argument will apply here. What they proposed is that the partition function is only non-analytic in the semi-classical limit, which in this case corresponds to taking k to infinity. And the way that this non-analyticity arises is because at finite values of k, this partition function is essentially a kth order polynomial. It has k zeros, and these zeros will all lie along some curve, which is the Bayes boundary. And then these zeros become dense along that curve of a large k limit, and it's the fact that these zeros are condensing which leads to a Bayes transition in the semi-classical limit. And indeed, I won't, of course, go through any of the proofs for you, but in fact, you can prove that the extremal partition functions that I wrote down have precisely this property. So here, now this is a test of the quality of your projector, because maybe you can see that we have zeros here that are becoming dense along these curves in the complex tau plane. And so you can just go ahead and prove in fact, the Hawking phase transition does occur as a Li Yang type phase transition in this case. And in fact, well, I won't go through any of the details, but it occurs for a wide class of holomorphic modeling partition functions. Okay, so maybe I should just conclude here and let you read these by yourself. It's gone over time. So, thank you.
Are there any additional questions?
So I apologize for going over time.
So
let me see if I can summarize the main result here is that...
But
one thing is that when you sum over complex geometries, you were summing over the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic part of the connection individually. And somehow these complex geometries are asymptotically ABS-free, real ABS-free.
That's right.
Okay. So, and then you found that when you do that, then the partition function is characterized.
That's right. And so maybe, I don't know what the plan is for tomorrow, but I think there's a lot of other interesting things to discuss with the problems and puzzles related with this, which I'm happy to talk with people about tomorrow, or right now, people are interested. I apologize again for going over again. This is part of the talk that I skipped. So when k equals 1, in the holomorphic case, we actually know what the conformal field theory is. This was in Newton's paper over the summer. It's this thing called the monster conformal field theory. But nobody has constructed the analogous conformal field theories for k bigger than 1. So maybe there's evidence going both ways. I mean, people have constructed the supergravity version of the homogeneous partition function and subjected it to a variety of tests. But there are also some arguments going the other way that maybe it doesn't exist. So I think it's still an open question. Yeah?
There may be some questions for the discussion tomorrow, to identify the CFT, we need not only to compute the partition function, we need to be able to compute the fusion rule.
So all that I've done so far is really about the torus partition function. And so CFT is a lot more than a partition function. And so, but for example, if you could calculate the all genus partition functions, then you could imagine shrinking, you could shrink the cycles down and use that to extract the correlation.
Could you give me, gravity computation, could you tell me what I should compute in quantum gravity in order to get, what is the dictionary from NDS-CFT? Gravity computation should I try to do?
If you could
get a fusion rule, assuming I can do it.
So, for example, if you could compute the all genus partition function.
Isn't genus two supposed to be?
Is there conjectures about that?
There are conjectures about that. So Davide and G had a paper, G had another paper.
But even conformal fit theory, isn't there a conjecture that the genus too? Some finite number would determine all the OPEs. So. So you have genus 2.
Yeah, this is only for k equals 2 and 3. This was with Davide and G. They used these old results of...
I'm thinking like 20 years ago. I thought it was...
They basically used these old results of Schenker and Ferdinand and people like that. Maybe I'm...
So you're saying, I would certainly, it would think that by shrinking the cycles, you could get the three-point functions.
Yeah, right.
And factorizing, you could get the three-point functions from genus 2.
Can I try something more dynamic? That is,
oh,
it's a year to identify.
So for example, if you could compute the three-point function with boundary insertions for the boundary stress tensor, that's the well.
So yeah, the perception from gravity. So from the CFT, I have primary fields.
The puzzling thing is that their primary fields, from the conformal field theory point of view, their primary fields corresponding to black holes, and it.
There should be a dictionary, just in principle. If there's an equivalence between gravity and CFT, there should be a something that can be a three-point function. These primaries correspond to these.
Well, so for example, in the semi-classical point of view, there's no way of distinguishing one black hole from another. Whereas in this monster conformal field theory, you can write down a list of these primaries. You know, for dimension one, there's 196,000 of them. You can write down a list, and you can tell them one from another. You can give them all names. But, if I hand you a black hole, there's, it's hard to look at that black hole. From a semi-classical point of view, I don't know how to tell you what the primary states are corresponding. I don't have a way of distinguishing these primary states. Maybe I'm not being very clear.
I don't know. From the CFT point of view, there will be local insertion right there. And then they carry charge and then you add all. So suppose I put three charge and infinity like that, then
so for example,
you know, some type of, you know.
So I think the computation you're describing is the one where I insert some descendants of the Virasoro operators. And that certainly is something that doesn't make sense to do.
Or some primary.
So with primaries, I just don't know what the bulk description of these primaries is, aside to say that they should correspond to black holes.
So you're saying there's no idiosyncratic dictionary?
Well, I don't know if I quantized the bulk three-dimensional gravity theory directly. If I did, then I would know what the primary state was. I mean, that's the whole, that's the problem.
Okay, anything else? You're going to let Spain just keep going.